You know, they make this big red button and it's like, oh, click.
Yeah, I should hit that. Yeah.
Well, hi, this is Paul. And on the channel today, I've got Trip. Trip's been on before. He did a Q&A on the Discord with Esther. You've been on a bunch of Rando's videos. You've been on my channel before. You've kind of told your story on my channel. And when I started talking about Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, that podcast, I started listening to it when I was on vacation, and Trip immediately was like, oh, we got to talk about this, because and so I'm gonna let you start talking about this, Trip. Why does this grab you? And you clearly had opinions on it, so I'm really curious to hear what you have.
Yeah, I mean, I moved out to Seattle in 2008 and immediately started attending Mars Hill. It was kind of like the big hot thing. It was like right at, you know, some of the upward swing. I mean, it was already large, but it was getting big and multi-site and moving into other states and everything else. So I kind of rode that upward wave. It's where a lot of my friends that I went to college with who were in Campus Crusade, they moved out here to work for Microsoft also. Before I did. So they were attending Mars Hill. So I went with them. You know, a lot of us had listened to some of Mark Driscoll in college because he was riding that emergent church wave. Right. And so he was getting more popular. So they moved out here, they started going, and then they were going to a small group. And so one of my friends was leading that small group. And so I started attending there. That was 2008. And that's where I met my wife. She happened to be in that small group. And so, you know, shortly after that, we got engaged. We did premarital counseling at Mars Hill, as well. I became, almost a deacon. I was in the process of becoming a deacon, but then also, I was a small group leader as well, during that time. And so I wrote it all the way up to when the mail went out that Mark had resigned. So I was still a member whenever he left the church, kind of abruptly. So I was up close and personal with a lot of those things. I knew a lot of the pastors that are, you know, involved or mentioned, not by name, but they're referred to in the podcast. So I have a lot to say about Mars Hill, and some of my experience there. And I think that there are some valuable things about the podcast, but I am concerned about the way that the podcast is being used and some of, I think, the implicit takeaways that the podcast creators want us to take from it. Yeah. And that's where it gets, you know, kind of like a lot of it is accurate, I think. Yeah. A lot of it's hard to argue with, right? Yeah. The actual tapes of these things being said and that kind of stuff. Like there's no context, like everyone was like, well, you heard it out of context. You're like, there's no context for that. That's awful.
Yeah. Well, let's back up and let's kind of storify this a little bit. So where did you move from? What kind of church did you leave? Where were you at? Why was Mars Hill attractive to you?
Yeah. So I went to, so I grew up PCA in Charlotte. And so I was at a PCA church there. At college, I went to Summit Church up in Raleigh, Durham. So I went to Duke. So I went to Summit Church, which is J.D. Greer's church. In Raleigh, Durham, who, you know, became the head of the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. So I was already used to kind of like, I'd become used to kind of like the large charismatic preacher, like mega church kind of thing. Like I'd already got used to that at Summit for good and for ill. So I moved out, you know, a lot of young men were, you know, especially Christian young men who were of the more reformed persuasion had been, Mark had become really popular, right? This is like when, you know, all of a sudden audio and video and stuff like that just started to make its way onto the internet so that you could listen to pastors preach across the country, you know, their sermons and that kind of stuff. So Mark had, in my circle at least, become very popular as kind of like a fresh take, I would say, like a more culturally relevant reformed voice. And so he had become, who was trying to speak specifically to men. And I think it's kind of like like you said in your previous video, it's kind of like the Jordan Peterson phenomenon. Like, you know, young men were looking for that. And so Mark definitely knew who he was talking to and made it very appealing for men. And I thought that a lot of what Mark was saying, like, was, I mean, it was orthodox, right? It was sound Reformed theology that was a little bit more culturally relevant. And so I think that's why for me and my friend group, he really resonated.
And so first impressions when you got to the church?
It was, even though I'd been to Summit and Summit was really large, it was a production, I would say. Like it was really, from the time that you walked in, the music, the smells, the sound, everything, the background noise.
Hey, we got smells at Living Stones.
No, yeah, probably not the same.
I don't think that I are to engineer the smells. A lot of times I'd like to get rid of them, but no, we got smells.
Yeah. But Mars Hill would, they would have like literal, like actually incense and stuff like that. Like it was dark when you walked in. The lighting, there was like usually like some kind of like smoke on stage and that kind of stuff. It was a production like I've never seen in an actual church.
Now when was Mars Hill started? Because I don't know a ton about this and I'm still just trying to get up to speed the facts, but you know, it seemed, and the podcast has borne this out. I mean, earlier he was sort of, you know, I made this video about him and Nadia Bowles Weber, which boy, a bunch of people got really annoyed with that on Twitter. It's like, oh, they're nothing alike. It's like, not so sure, because you know, some of the earlier videos he's like, wow, we're gonna keep this church small, and you know, right, if the church is big it's apostasy. But it sounds like when you got there they had already sort of bitten into the mega church thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was started I think in 1996. And so it was, you know, 12 years old by the time I actually started attending. Mark had become kind of a celebrity pastor by that point. Yeah, so it was already large by that, not anywhere near what it ended up becoming at its zenith. So it was large. It was probably, you know, maybe 1,000 people, but it became much larger than that. Obviously, with campuses spanning like 3 states and that kind of stuff. I think like 15 total locations at one point. Okay. So it was a one location church that was large, had 3 services with, you know, 200 to 400 people at each service. The one at night was mainly college students. So that's where my wife tended to go. Those sermons also tended to be more vulgar, a little bit looser. And like he knew the audience that he was playing to. So like the families, the sermons were a little bit more tame, a little bit less like, you know, vulgar and that kind of stuff, which is some of the criticism that other conservative pastors had of Mark at the time. Yeah. Is that like, this is not, a pastor should not be speaking this way. Yeah. But the college students liked it. And so they all went to that edgier evening service. But it was about 1,000 people when I went there, but it ended up becoming like, I don't know, 10,000 or something like that.
Now that's huge for Seattle, because I was just up in Seattle just briefly, and you can tell culturally it's different from California. It's pretty grungy. Yeah. There's a lot of grunge in Seattle.
Yeah, totally.
And not a lot of churches. Most of the churches that I drive by were sort of small and, oh, we're still alive, I swear.
Yeah, totally. That's, I mean, it was at the time, you know, he would always say this, that Seattle was the least church city in North America. And I don't think that's any longer the case. I think that, you know, Mars Hill got a lot of people to go to church that weren't going to church. But usually around here, it's mainline Protestant denominations. Those are most of the churches that you see, you know, Methodist, Episcopal, you know, PC, USA, that kind of thing. So, but Mars Hill was different. And it didn't even try to walk the Seattle kind of more progressive line. It almost like was more antagonistic, which got it a lot of notoriety in the city. And, you know, for good and ill, it got people in the church and it got a lot of people looking at the church. So
the counterculture, I mean, this is obviously big on YouTube and social media. I was just watching David Fuller's conversation with Chris Williamson, which is, I think, excellent. And, you know, Chris Williamson makes the point that there's, you know, one of the ways to gain a big following is to be basically reactive. Yeah. And you could imagine with such a strong progressivist vibe in the Pacific Northwest that that's you know, even if that's the majority of the population, there's still going to be a significant number of people who are going to be attracted to something reactive because they feel that reactivity in them. And then here is a place that's validating it. They're maybe putting better words on it than I can. I mean, there's certainly something to that with the Jordan Peterson movement too. So how, you know, for you now, you already were a Christian and obviously you went to a church, and most people go to church with a combination of both to grow in faith, but also as a place to serve. I mean, being a member of a church should have both of those things. How, when you think back on who you were as a Christian, then how did being a member there and participating there, what happened to your Christian life and to your spiritual life in that context?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that it definitely, I think it almost made you want to become more of an activist, I would say.
Huh.
Like it was less like personal contemplative, more of an activist, more of an outward. Okay, I'll say this at Mars Hill, being gifted was more valued than being godly.
Huh.
So if you were talented and you could make things happen, or you could like stir the pot, if you can get attention, if you can get people in the pews, if you can grow your community group, if you can grow your small group, grow your campus, grow Mars Hill, being gifted in that way was actually seen as godliness in some sense. God was blessing you with fruit, essentially. And so that, I think, was, it shifted my focus as a Christian less on kind of examining my own life and, you know, really trying to hold myself accountable. And like, I just see that drift that it was very outward focused. It's how do we do something that moves the needle, and less focused on, you know, how am I doing spiritually? So I would say that that was kind of the focus, the locus of my attention was outward, toward moving the needle, making things happen. Can we measure this? What's the metrics? That kind of thing, rather than, you know, actually like, how are you doing? You know?
Yeah. That measurement, I mean, part of the reason I'm interested in this podcast series is because it gets at, in many ways, the major evangelical movements of the last 40 years. And that point that you just made now is a key because, you know, when I look back at, say, Willow Creek, and then, you know, after 20 years of Willow Creek, they decided to do a study, you know, because it's deeply sociological, decided to do a study on, well, have our members grown spiritually? Okay, well, then you need a ruler. So they developed a ruler, and then they had, I don't remember the name of it right now, but I have a friend who's been in coaching. He's been deep into the seeker stuff. And so then Willow Creek said, we haven't really moved the needle in terms of our people, in terms of their spirit. So then they, you know, the whole nother process and in terms of spiritual growth, but that being able to, it's interesting because it's sort of an empiricism, sort of its own social scientism that gets into that particular church culture.
Yeah. And I think that was particularly appealing to me. Like I'm a computer science major, you know, and so I work in tech, that's what I do. So like, I'm very used to the conversations around metrics. How do we measure this? How do we make sure that it's doing the right thing? All that kind of stuff. And, you know, especially like it's necessary in tech to do that. But I think that you're right. I think that once you start saying, well, this is the metric, these are our KPIs, this is what we're going to, how we're going to measure this, a lot of times you stop caring about anything that you can't measure. Like that's the only thing that you focus on. So like maybe you move the needle on the things that you're measuring, but you stop caring about everything else.
Yeah. 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 Wow. So you got involved. What was small group life like as compared to the big show?
Small group, we met in people's houses or apartments or whatever. So yeah, there was usually a program that went alongside the sermon series that we were going on. So like the leaders did have some freedom to deviate from that and that kind of stuff. But generally you were expected to take kind of the program that goes alongside the sermon series, have a couple extra like scriptural readings. And then like there's Q&A kind of like round table, just like, let's all talk about it. You'd have meals together. So I think this is where like, actually you might like it. My wife's uncle works as a professor of religion. He's the chair of the department at University of Washington. He's more progressive, but he's a Christian, and he wrote a book called High on God. And so like he was very critical of Marcel. He had a very bad experience, which we could talk about with Mark Driscoll. But he wrote this book. He's written a couple books. One is conservative or evangelical versus liberal, kind of comparing and contrasting like what the spiritual life is like and the church life is like for conservatives and liberals and or evangelicals and liberals in the church. And he came away with some surprise. I was surprised that he wrote the book, because he's a liberal but it was very,
it's helpful to say in this context, when you mean liberal, you're talking modernist, you know, you're talking that, yeah. Because the word liberal is just all over the place now.
Yeah. So maybe I can use progressive or something like that, but like politically that he's on that side. Right. So, and more, a little bit more like liberal theology, I would say, and that kind of thing. So, anyway, but he wrote a book and he talked about the kind of the spiritual lives of conservatives. I was surprised he wrote it, because it was actually very complimentary of the more evangelical faith, which he doesn't find himself in. Like he's more mainline Protestant. Yeah. But then he wrote a second book called High on God. And it was about why are people attracted to mega churches? Like, what are they like? What is that like? Like, what are they doing? And actually he came away, even though he was very critical of Marcel Hill and Mark Driscoll, he came away saying that there's a lot of things that mega churches can provide people by way of community, especially in large cities, that smaller churches just can't do.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of resources to do a lot of things. And so like one of the things that, you know, we did, yeah, I mean, it was weekly. We would meet, we would all have dinner together and, you know, kind of like, and it was kind of an anchor. That was really your community within the church. You didn't know, unless you were, you know, teaching a group or you were an elder or deacon, you didn't know Mark, you didn't know the pastors, you didn't know the elders, you didn't know any of these guys. You knew your small group leader and the people within your community. So that's, it served some of the functions of maybe of a smaller church where you get to know people on a deeper level. But that's what it was. So it was a combination of fellowship and then a little bit of teaching and kind of, you know, kind of deconstructing the sermon and what is it and does anyone have questions about it and that kind of stuff. So that's what being a small group leader was.
Yeah. And that, you know, part of what I want to dig into, I mean, when I'd heard some advertising on Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, I thought, oh, I'd be interested in that. And then CT was doing it. And then it's just very produced. And if you want to be part of a growing movement, I thought, you're deconstructing this playing it.
You're doing the same thing. Yes, you're doing the exact same thing.
That's why it was like Gorbachev and the Soviet Union.
Yes.
It's like,
no, that was a great line.
Yeah. Really? That's what I mean. You're and I'm waiting for the next episode. And at the same time, like you said, I really love the podcast. It's in a lot of ways, it's really good, but it's just, I keep my finger on the fast forward button to go through the music and the little promos and the in-house advertising. It's like,
in some ways they inherited the same, like the legacy of Mars Hill in certain ways by producing it this way. And also, I guess that's one of my, I mean, we can keep talking about my experience at Mars Hill before we get to the podcast.
Well, I just want to make a point about the small groups that, I mean, when you look at the mega church, this is designed. I mean, mega churches don't just happen.
Right.
They like to say they just happen. Right. And partly they do, because for every one church that goes mega, there's 50 that wanted to and failed.
Right. Yeah.
But there's, I mean, the small group is designed exactly for that reason. And the whole thing is, in fact, a fairly well thought through, designed, studied. One of the things that people don't realize about church is sometimes we'll say, people say to me sort of naively, wow, I wonder if anybody like studies church. And it's like, you have no idea how study yes. church. Is. And if there's an area of church that's studied, it's evangelical mega church. I mean, this stuff is studied at depths you would not believe.
Right.
Social.
No, the people besides Mark that were surrounding him up at the top, these are former like CFOs of major companies. These guys are not dummies. Like it's just like happenstance. They know exactly what they're doing. They know how to expand. They know which locations to look at for the next site. And like where are we pulling our demographics from? So where are the community groups going to be located? All of that is like, it's the same thing you would do if you were like running a major business. This is not just like local small town pastor starts a mega church. Like, no, that doesn't happen. Like,
I came to Southern California with me and my family and my wagon, and I handed out some flyers and I said, exactly. You know, what would happen to you? No, what if you were to go to church, what kind of church would you like to go to? I don't want it to be boring. It won't be boring.
Right. Yes, exactly. This is not John the Baptist in the wilderness with people coming to him. Like, this is a business. It's run like a business.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, but that it does garner a lot of resources that a smaller church simply can't cater to. Like, I mean, Marcel had, children's ministries for special needs kids,
yeah.
Right? These were specialists who were trained to so if you had an autistic kid, yeah. You could be comfortable putting them in there. They had background checks for everything was done.
It's very competent to use a Jordan Peterson.
But if you've ever Yes, but if you've ever been to like a small church, good luck having an autistic kid and be able to also attend that church, right?
I know.
And that's not to pick on small churches. They just don't have the resources to do that. And so like you can garner a lot of resources and you can minister to a lot of people doing it this way. We went through premarital counseling. I think there were probably 100, there were probably 50 couples in quarterly. They do a premarital counseling for people who are about to get married. And so there are probably 50 couples in the quarter that we went through. And I bet everyone was the same.
Now talk to me about that, because of course the one of the things that, it's super salient in the culture right now. It's, men, women, and Driscoll. And that's very big in the podcast. Yeah. So what was premarital counseling like there?
It's pretty much what you would expect. The guy who ran it, his name was Phil, and his wife, they ran it. So Mark didn't run that particular ministry or whatever. So really Mark cared about the theology, and really the theology was a complementarian theology of marriage and how men and women need to relate to each other. And you walk through the theology. So there's, a couple books that you go through and worksheets, kind of workbooks that you each answer. And then you sit down with a pastor and we talk about it and that kind of thing. Honestly, the premarital counseling, it's not the worst I've seen. I don't know.
It can get pretty bad.
It can. Yeah. So I think that first of all, the pastor was one of the, we can talk about this a little bit later, but he's one of the ones that left the church kind of saying he got fired from the church. Because he was asking too many questions. He was pushing back a little bit too hard about some of the shadier things that were going on. And so they canned him. So I have a lot of respect for Phil. I think that the problem with the premarital counseling is not so much the complementarian thing. I generally agree with it. I think that it just wasn't, it tells you a lot of what not to do. Right. But not a lot of what really you should be doing and why. Like there wasn't a huge positive vision for marriage. It was more what do not do before marriage mainly. And then during marriage, high level, but it's typical premarital counseling. I think within the church, it's a lot of don't do this before you're married, but once you're married, go figure it out yourself. Right. There's the very little. So it was kind of a production. And I think most people did it because they wanted the pastor or elder at Mars Hill, if you wanted them to officiate your wedding, you had to go through the premarital counseling or they weren't going to do it. So I think a lot of people were there for that reason.
Did you get married then at Mars Hill?
No, we got married. I had one of my one of my old youth pastors from Kansas City, he flew out and he officiated a wedding because I knew the pastors, but I didn't know them super well on a really personal level. And so I felt more comfortable with, you know, one of my old pastors doing it because he knew us. And we actually did like a separate premarital counseling with him so that he was comfortable with where we were at. But yeah, I wanted it to be more personal than I was going to get at Marcel.
Okay. So did you at some point get a sense while you were there that, I mean, certainly there had to be talk in the church about, gosh, this pastor, you know, we like his sermons, we like this stuff, but, and some of this comes through in the interviews and the podcast, but some of, you know, you got some issues, or the dude's got some issues. Okay.
For sure.
We're willing to look past them, but the dude's got some issues.
Yeah, totally. So I went, whenever I started going there, apparently Mars Hill had just like lost half of their attendees. And this was like in 2008. So there was a big split in the church and a lot of elders and pastors left because of a dispute with Mark. And we don't know a ton. I don't know a ton of details about it. No one really knew other than there was Mark just told them to get out. And so they left. And so like the church was actually a lot smaller even whenever I got
there. Pastor
can
do that?
Yeah.
Right? I haven't tried that yet. Get out.
Yeah. Well, you're in an actual denomination. So there was no one that was going to hold Mark accountable for that. He was too big at that point, I think, for anyone to do it. He wasn't going to accept it. Even at the end, he wouldn't accept it. So
that was clear.
Yeah. So it had already, there had already been like a schism kind of within the church, even whenever right before I got there. And I was like, I never really got the full details. It was a lot of like behind closed doors. I bet there were NDAs involved with a lot of the pastors who got, you know, severance packages and that kind of thing. So I bet that was very common at Marcel too. So that was one red flag, but I was like, but I didn't know the guys who left either, right? And so I didn't know exactly what had gone on. And so anyway, so I was still going. I went there. So there was that. A couple years in, that's when he had the famous screaming at men, "You're not a man" sermon that you can watch on YouTube of him just screaming for like 90 minutes. And so there was that. And we're like, that, I mean, it seems weird to do in church, but okay. So there was that. And then there was just like constant turnover of the pastoral and elder staff. Like people would burn out really soon. It's almost like working at Amazon where the average tenure is like 18 months. And that was weird. And then they fired Pastor Phil, who did our premarital counseling. And that's when I was like, okay, like this guy is one of the most soft-spoken. Like he's not the kind of guy who rocks the boat or and he still, to my knowledge, has not publicly said anything about what happened. But in talking to some of the pastors, he was asking too many questions. He was too critical. And so basically Mark said, well, you're not on the same mission as the church. And that's when a few of my friends who actually like, you know, I went to a small group with, they left the church at that point because they said, well, if Pastor Phil's not on the mission of the church, then we're not either. I don't know exactly what you guys are saying, but like, if he's not, then we're out. But they knew him a little bit better than I did. And so I stayed. One of the biggest eye-opening things was, okay, they were getting a lot of criticism from the small group leaders. There was a lot of turnover in the pastoral staff and the elder staff, and not a lot of communication going down to even the people who were volunteering at the church about what was going on. This is when like Warren Throckmorton was writing like almost daily about accusations of abuse and that kind of stuff at Mars Hill. And like, we were just like, okay, but the church isn't saying anything. Like it's completely silent, even to its leaders. And so, I think that, you know, a lot of people left, but then I think they were trying to fix that. And so then like occasionally the small group leaders and some of the deacons and that kind of stuff, or like me, I was, you know, in the process of becoming a deacon, were invited to some of like the staff meetings and that kind of stuff with the pastors. And so Mark was there. And so Mark was at the head of the table, of course. And he looked at this guy, his name was Pastor Alex. So he was, Alex was the lead pastor at one of the locations east of Seattle in Sammamish. So that's a more like suburb of Seattle. So anyway, so it's a smaller community. Anyway, so they launched the location there. And I remember Mark, we sat down and he's like, okay, let's get this started and that kind of stuff. We're going to go like kind of location by location and talk about things. And he looked at Alex, slammed his head on his hand on the table and yelled at him, be like, you are failing at your job. And I was like,
this is an open meeting.
In an open meeting in front of 24 people.
Okay.
You're failing. And it was the what he was referring to was that their campus was not growing fast enough. And wow. I could just see like just total fear on this guy's face, yeah. Like just terrified of Mark. And I got to know Alex really well after that because we ended up going to the same church after Mark still fell. And he's just like the most meek guy that you will ever meet, just super soft spoken. And you could just tell Mark didn't respect that at all. Like he wouldn't have done this to just anyone. It was almost like bully behavior. Like bullies don't randomly pick their targets.
Yeah.
This guy was, you know, the target. And anyway, I Alex is a great guy. He just retired actually recently, but yeah, I didn't know Alex super well at the time, but I was just super confused. I was like, I must be missing something, right? Like you don't, in any other context, church or not, if someone does that, that's a problem, right? Yeah. Like as hard and as like brutal as Amazon can be, if you did that in a meeting at Amazon, you're going to get like, that's not okay. Like there will be consequences for it. And, he was just totally comfortable with doing it. And to my knowledge, everyone just kind of like, I mean, you can see the body language. Everyone just kind of like looked away. And that was the meeting was just,
why did everyone just kind of tolerate this? I mean, because, it sounded like it's a long burn up until finally at the end and they got critical mass to say, hey, we're done being, you know.
Yeah, but that's the thing, like it's weird because it's like Mark wanted he wanted non-meek men who would always do what he says, right? He wanted like men who were like, you know, not meek, they like they're aggressive and they're, you know, they're whatever. And then also you need to be yes men for me, and you could see why then there would be so much turnover in the staff, because those personality things, that doesn't mesh, right? You can't do that. But yeah, I mean, that was my read of it, is at least it explained a lot about why there was so much turnover, because there are some people who are like, their humility almost goes too far. And their meekness almost goes too far. Well, they'll take that for a longer period of time. And some people won't. And like, they'll burn out and they're like, I'm not going to take this. Why should I? And then it started to make sense to me. So that was when like, but that was toward the end. That was probably like the last 6 months. And then even at the end, you know, as the podcast mentions, like we were trying to restore him as pastor. Like they weren't trying to run him out and that kind of stuff, and he just, God told me to leave. But that was when you're like, okay, like what it was he was finally like, there was finally going to be an authority, like the church was going to actually discipline him, and he just wanted nothing to do with that whatsoever. So God released him and then he just got up and left. But like that wasn't the purpose, wasn't to get him out of the pulpit or to, you know, like that wasn't even at that point that wasn't what the church was going to do, even though maybe it should have. But you could just tell at that point he didn't want that. He wanted yes men, and it was clear at that point things had gotten too far that he wasn't just going to get carte blanche anymore. And so he just left.
Now looking back on it, would you go to a church like that again? And when you say and what do I mean by like that? I mean, you've got a dictatorial, tyrannical pastor who preaches accountability except for him.
Yeah. No, I think that was one of the main lessons, like I said earlier, is that it's a, you know, if you read 1 Timothy 3 about, you know, the leaders in the church and that kind of thing, like only one of the things listed has to do with being gifted, right? So like there's teaching, but everything else is about godliness. everything else. And so I think that like, that was one of the big lessons to me is you see these like, these really, a really talented person. Like he is talented. There's no doubt about that. He's charismatic. He's funny. And you know, he can make a sermon that resonates with people, that sticks with them. And he can make, in some sense, he can take like theology and make it appealing to people to apply to their lives. But that doesn't mean, you're godly just because you have that gift. And so a lot of times a rising star, you like, even if the person has it within them to become the kind like to mature and to change and that kind of stuff, if the rising star is rising too fast, there's not enough time for the godliness to catch up with how talented they are. And I think that that was my main lesson, was that you, the pastor and the leadership of the church, like godliness needs to come first, and then we'll see who's talented and who can do what. But that's, I wouldn't go to a church where I didn't feel like, no, that guy is a mature, godly man, whether or not they're talented. That needs to, that's like my first because then I believe also that there's people around him who will hold him accountable, and he wants that. Yeah. Someone who's kind of a narcissist and you know, not mature in that way, not godly, they're going to surround themselves with the least amount of accountability as possible. Yeah. And that's what happened to Marcel.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's shift and let's talk about the podcast a little bit. Yeah. So were you surprised when you first heard this podcast coming out?
A part of me was surprised. A part of me was not surprised. Like obviously Christianity Today and Mark Driscoll are not in the same tribe anymore, in a lot of ways. They've kind
of, that's a really interesting statement, because they are and they aren't. And you start getting into little sub-tribes.
Yeah. Right. So yes, Christianity Today, I think, used to be in that tribe. I think that the people running it today are not in that tribe anymore. I think that you can see this even in how they juxtapose different people with Mark and the rise of the young, restless and reformed, and like the positive aspect of the people who went kind of left, and then Mark who went right. And then they juxtapose Mark with, you know, they bring in people like Rachel Held Evans to kind of critique him. And they're always painted in kind of like the positive light of like, you know, critiquing Mark, and Mark's in the wrong. And so I think that I was surprised, but I wasn't surprised, because I think at this point, Christianity is going to be very comfortable just laying out the dirty truth of Marcel, because I don't feel like they feel connected to it. So I was surprised a little bit, but also not surprised. It is also a salacious story. And obviously I think it's like top 20 podcasts total right now.
Really?
Yes. It's one of the largest podcasts in the country right now. So it's salacious. It's, you know, interesting. It's well produced. You wouldn't know that Netflix didn't make this.
Yeah. No, I know. I mean, when I first listened to it, I thought, wow, and you know, you see the values of my podcast. Well produced. Nobody's ever accused me of that.
Yeah. So I was surprised, but not super surprised. I was surprised at the quality. I did not know that Christianity Today would turn out something like that. For better or for worse, I guess it is well done. I guess but that can be a detriment too. And I have the same critique of like a lot of Netflix documentaries, is that sometimes the slick production lulls people into like not actually thinking or reflecting on it. And so you just kind of like consume. I'm just going to consume whatever they're telling me, like implicitly and explicitly, and I'm going to stop critiquing it. I think that's my issue with the podcast, is that there's a lot of tacit things that they're, and implicit messages that they're giving you without actually saying it. And the production value almost makes it so that you can just sit back and be entertained by this story. So you don't actually critically think about what's going on. And I think that's obvious by who they choose to bring in to talk about it, outside of Marcel. Like, it's one thing to interview the pastors and some of these people that were part of it or play recordings, but you're bringing in some people that Like, who are you bringing in? Who do you choose to bring in?
You know, this is part of the, it's the experts. Well, who are these experts? And I mean, that's a big part of modernity. It's a big part of that whole package is the expert. And I'm not saying expertise, but there's expertise is always situated.
Right.
And
who are you bringing in and who do you consider an expert on this? And so it reminds me a lot of what C.S. Lewis described as Bulverism. And so, you know, you're bringing in, like, I don't think the podcast or any of the people outside of Marcel critiquing it, I don't think they quoted the Bible once. I think the only people that you hear quoting the Bible is when they play something that Mark said, or, you know, Mark saying, God told me this and that kind of stuff. So, like, what's the implicit message there? This isn't like a sociological, psychological reduction of Mars Hill and Mark. But you're not bringing a theologian to say, hey, here's where we think Mark went wrong, or, like, you know, here's what the effect of this, the abuse of this type of theology is. Like, the first episode they're talking about, maybe it was the Joshua Harris one, but they started off linking complementarian theology with, like, Christian nationalism like a sociological, like, phenomenon. And you're like, what is your message here, right? Are you just like, so you've decided that he's wrong, and so we're just going to explain away how he got here from a psychological perspective, as if, like, that undermines this. And anyway, so it reminds me of C.S. Lewis's Bulverism critique. Like, you need to actually deal with the, if you're going to critique complementarian theology, you need to critique it theologically, not just explain, hey, the Soviet Union happened and that had this effect on the American psyche or whatever. Even if that's true, that's beside the point. Like, what is the theological issue at play? And that's part of what I think is implicitly throughout this entire thing, is that they're painting the theology of Mark Driscoll as wrong. And without actually dealing with it theologically, they're saying, well, here's bad things that happened in Mars Hill. That was paired with complementarian. We can explain this away sociologically. So be like Rachel Held Evans or some of these other people who are just nicer, right? They didn't have this kind of fall from grace. And so you should just stay away from this, like, bad stuff. And so I think that's my irritation with the podcast is, A, the slick production hides the fact that that's what they're doing. But that's a very clear message that at least I get throughout, is they're not dealing with this theologically. They're just explaining it away and, like, kind of pairing it together with the bad stuff that happened, as if, like, these are necessary, as if the complementary theology always results in narcissistic Mark Driscoll types doing this kind of thing. So anyway, that's my irritation with it, I guess. Yeah. What's your take on it?
I don't know. How much time do we have?
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about this because there's so much to it. I mean, I think your critique is valid, and I've seen that in a number of, I know, you know, given the way Jordan Peterson has sort of demonized postmodernity, part of the irony of postmodernity is a lot of people who are sort of out there shilling postmodernism as the great new way need to hold up a mirror to themselves and say, you know, all of this, there's so much sort of slid under the carpet of this isn't healthy. Oh, okay. Well, where's your yardstick for health?
Right.
I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that's just deeply embedded. And okay, so you're deconstructing this. Well, why don't we deconstruct some of this over here? Because it's what you have is a terribly selective, you know, this is when it's okay to yell and this is when it isn't. Okay, well, let's talk about yelling. And what tends to get carried on is sort of this American assumption that morality is self-evident, but that now we all in a sense embrace our morality in sort of a naive way. You kind of have to do that for it to be your operating system, but it's not self-evident, a lot of these metrics that are being used to get into this. And so I'm gonna probably use it as a jumping off point for a lot of things, because it intersects with so many things going on right now. And just the path of Christianity today, I've been using Molly Worthen's book on Apostles of Reason, which is a very interesting book. You know, every author has their perspective, but Molly does a good job of cataloging a ton of very interesting little tidbits that are salient in terms of what goes into the creation of this kind of church, towards what and you know, I'm going to check out these books of your wife's uncle that you mentioned, because there's a lot to look at there. And what's so interesting about Driscoll is that you have the combination of a number of things. It's hard to deny that in some ways, some of the features of his personality, which led to the fall, were exactly what gave them the rise.
Yep.
And that's, and I think the podcast, actually, I think in a lot of ways, I'm very impressed by the podcast. It does an amazing job at a lot of things. I wish it would go a little deeper, but then again, Christianity today is always meant to be, we'll go so far.
Right.
And to ask much, much deeper questions about, let's talk about how to, in a culture like ours, you know, first, you know, mass media and then cable TV and then internet, where a guy like Mark Driscoll can very quickly become a celebrity, often sort of out of hooking people with they're tired of sort of the main propaganda. And so you hook them with a counter message, and you reinforce that counter message, you validate that counter message. Nowhere in any of this are you doing too much analysis in terms of, let's look at the main message and let's look at the counter message. And what yardsticks are we going to use to evaluate these? So, and the podcast, I agree with you, especially the episode on women, it's okay, podcaster, put some of your cards on the table.
Yeah, and exactly.
In all fairness, the podcaster could say, well, they don't really care to spend all the time to look at all of my cards. And I'd say, all right, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't at least put a table out there somewhere where some particularly nosy person might actually, and not to be critical, but to dialogue about this and say, here are your positions. Let's talk about them. What do you think of them? And it's that.
Well, at least then we would know where you're coming from whenever you like choose to interview the people that you're interviewing, and you're choosing to frame in a certain way. Like it's more obvious to people, oh, this is where that person's coming from. But whenever you obfuscate that, and then, but you're still choosing, right? You're still choosing the plot points that you want to put in this narrative.
Yeah.
And that's my problem with it, is that and the slick production value will kind of lull people into just kind of absorbing it.
Yeah.
And in some sense, that's a lot of what Mark did too, is, you know, like this, in that way, I agree with you. Like Christianity is just doing the same thing. They're just now the counter message to Mark Driscoll is the more popular one that people want to hear. And so now they're just riding that wave to be one of the most like popular podcast in the world right now, which is crazy.
And that's so interesting. Why? And this is, you know, obviously been all over the Jordan Peterson stuff too. Why this issue? Why this person? Why here? Why now? And then we can even deconstruct some of the, why are you asking why? Do you want to get in on the bandwagon? Do you want to get your, you know, spot in the trough? Is that good? Is that bad? So it's interesting stuff. Well, I'm curious about now. When it comes through very clearly in the podcast, and I part of the another thing that struck me throughout the podcast is that, so because of this, I've been, you know, catching little snippets of Driscoll sermons, and I haven't really found, this gets to the whole plagiarism episode, but I haven't really found much of anything terribly original that I've heard from him. I mean, no. I'm quite familiar with a lot of Tim Keller's stuff, mm-hmm. a, a little bit familiar with some of Piper's stuff. I have other thoughts about some of this other crew in the Young Restless and Reformed tribe, but you know, every time, so then I'd find, okay, what videos of his really caught it? I'd listen to it and I'd think he's just retreading all of the stuff that was sort of out there in the ecosystem. And if, you know, as a pastor, I've got a better sense of the ecosystem. So it's like, he's much more of a popularizer. Here's this idea that's really gotten hot. He's able to sort of package it. And there is a sense in this attention economy where if everyone's sort of hitting an eight, if you go up to a nine, and I see that with a lot of the things, we're going to be hardcore complementarians and we're going to be hardcore reformed. And now he's done with the reformed and we're going to be hardcore accountability.
I know. I listened to that where he's just like talking, you know, Calvinists are just like men with daddy issues or something. I was like, what were you doing for like 15 years at Mars Hill? Like, is that what you were playing on? Did you know this at the time? Like what? But there's no introspection with him. He's just like, he just throws that out there as if he wasn't preaching Calvinist theology for like 15 years at Mars Hill. And then I question, like, do you regret that? Or did you know that that's what you were doing? If that's what you think you were doing, like, was this intentional? I'm just curious. But there's absolutely no introspection with him.
Yeah. Well, so what happened? You get the sense from the podcast, and correct me if I'm wrong, that basically finally people have sort of had enough. There's critical mass now to, okay, we're going to stand up to the bully. And we're going to sit him down. And this is sort of a character test, which he rather dramatically fails. My wife and we both heard from God. We were in separate rooms that we're released. And then they go down to Arizona. And, you know, again, we're all dependent on sources.
Knowing the people that were involved in the discussion, that's an accurate, I think, description of how that went. He also later on, I think the podcast touches on this. He also later on told a pastor, he's like, well, I knew that you were going to stab me in the back if I had stayed or something like that. Yeah. And you're like, okay, we have a Minority Report pastor here, knowing people's sins before they do it, but okay.
It's all about allegiance and betrayal. Yes. Okay, you told us a lot about yourself. And in case nobody had noticed at this point, but what was it like in the church? Because I mean, a big part of this question about church is, and I've seen this evolution in the Christian Reformed Church, you know, because my grandfather was a pastor, my father was a pastor. I mean, basically in my grandfather's era, churches were, in a sense, communities that had local, these elders were sort of like tribal elders. They were people in the community that were well known, but they were sort of in charge of the church and they ran the church. They were the church, and pastors could sort of come and go. So the longest I think my grandfather spent in any one church was maybe 6 or 8 years. So pastors, you'd cycle in and out. Pastors are sort of scholar preachers who may be more exciting. And so that's what happens. That's the old CRC system, you know, and that's different from many other systems. There's lots of different subtleties in ecclesiology.
Well, even in Presbyterian and the PCA, the pastor is not a member of the church. The pastor is the member of the presbytery. And so the presbytery chooses where, and they typically don't move people around like that, but that's I think it stems from that older system of the pastors would kind of be on a circuit or they would move around, but the church, the elders were supposed to be the ones, the leaders of the church. And then, yeah, you had this like scholar that came around and taught occasionally. One other thing to say is that I don't want to give the leadership who was at this point trying to hold Mark accountable too much credit, to be frank, because what was happening was a lot of the people were leaving. The church had been aggressively expanding finding new, like signing new leases, really expensive leases and really expensive parts of town and that kind of stuff, because that was where the demographics showed that they would get the most attendees. And whenever the scandal kept increasing and becoming public, eventually you would have small group leaders or elders who would be fed up and they would leave. And then you'd be just be hemorrhaging members, people tithing.
Giving and units. Kind of stuff.
Exactly. And so what would happen at the big locations like the Ballard campus in Seattle or the Dan's building in Bellevue, which is where I went, which is where most of those were the biggest campuses. That's where the money was coming from to finance this expansion. Yeah. Once you started losing 10, 20, 30%, now all of a sudden you can't pay the lease that you just signed. And so part of the accountability was the elders saying, like, we have to stop the scandal. Like, this is actually affecting our ability to. So at some point they were almost forced to do it. Not wow. Like, and it was less risky to do that than it was to not do it at that point. So I'm going to be a little bit more critical, maybe even than the podcast would be, on those people, because like, they didn't do it when it was hard. They did it when they had no choice. And then Mark did what he did and that kind of blew up the church. But yeah, I mean, what you had was, in similar vein to what you were talking about with the elders, like the community group leaders, the small group leaders, and kind of the shepherding elders, those were the ones that actually knew the people in the seats, right? We were the ones having dinner with them, talking through the sermons. We were involved in their lives and their marriages and all that kind of stuff. Like, we were the ones. And so what happened was, like, just one by one, people would just get burned out. I can't do this anymore. I'm tired of this. I'm leaving. And then, generally speaking, that entire community group would leave, and then they would go and find a new church together. And so you almost had like little mini churches, like kind of mini groups of people that just left. And so everyone went to Reach Church, or everyone went here to following this elder or this. My friend, like I said, he left after this pastor got fired, and then his entire community group left with them. And some of them stopped going to church altogether. I think some of them still haven't gone to church.
Yeah.
So there's definitely been some people that just like, now they're anti-institutional religion and that kind of stuff, which is another one of the dangers of the podcast, I think, that I worry about, is popularizing this story a little bit too much. Because then you might have people saying, see, this is why this gives me justification for not wanting to be a part of a church, because everyone, all these pastors are so, you know, narcissistic and blah, blah, blah. And it kind of gives, like, you could see how it would give cover to someone who to not be a part of the church. But yeah, I mean, that's what happened. It was like everyone, it was kind of like the constant stream of scandals, the lack of communication from the church. Just, you had elders and pastors and then community group leaders leaving. And so, yeah, I mean, our community group left with us. Once kind of the leader left, generally speaking, the community group left too.
There's a former member of my church, still a friend. And I won't go into, I got to be a little careful because every now and then someone from my church watches my videos. So, but that this dynamic of these small groups or community groups of these now sort of becoming units that sort of go to different churches together. I've seen that here too, because I know someone who, they left this church, went to the mega church, and then had a community group then in that mega church. And then I don't know how it goes, but at some point they all then, you know, at least some of them start going to a different church, and then some of them start going to a different church. You know, I've also got people, and I talked with this, my friend Rod, who's from Tucson, about, you know, people who will come and they'll do small groups here at Living Stones, but they'll kind of, while they're doing small groups here, they kind of just do mega churches. Because again, you've got, you know, great music. At least you've got music tailored to whatever it is you're looking for from music. You've got services, you've got a sense of validation in that. We're part of a growing movement.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Every time I hear that in the podcast, it's just like, am I really this cynical?
Right.
Be part of a growing movement.
Right.
Ooh.
Yeah. I think that I don't know if you ever watched South Park, but South Park has this episode where they're critiquing people who are critiquing Walmart. And so like they burned down the Walmart, right? Because Walmart's bad. And so then they're like, we're all going to go and like start shopping at this like local mom and pop shop. And then it just shows the mom and pop shop getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until they finally burn it down and be like, well, we won't make that mistake again. Here, let's all go shop over here now. And it reminds me of this, you're critiquing a movement by starting a move. You're doing the same thing. You're part of the same pattern. Yeah. It just reminded me of that.
Yeah. We'll have to find that South Park.
Yeah.
No. And it's, you know, and part of what, where I want to go is I look at this is obviously I'm doing it through, and the episode, the second episode does a nice job of church growth, seeker, emergent. And then what it doesn't do a good enough job is to show this bifurcation in the emergent movement. And two of the arms, and actually the two Mars Hills are quite interesting because, as I said, Rob Bell and Mark Driscoll are born 49 days apart. I thought, 49, there's a fun number. and so, you know, Nadia Boltz-Weber, she in many ways typifies that other branch, and they're sort of direct opposite. And then again, how they're played off in American culture, especially in mass media, you know, where Christianity today fits in that matrix in terms of what, you know, what Christianity today has always sort of been doing and wanting to be. And of course, Rachel Held Evans is in there. All of these lights of the emergent and where both have sort of gone, at least branches of them, because it is a big tree and there's lots of different branches of it. And it's, so then I looked at, you know, then I started doing some clicking on, what about some of these other emergent church, you know, because this is a pushback against seeker. And one of the things that was clear in the podcast, it was clear from Driscoll, when you get to a certain size, it's really hard not to be that Walmart. I mean, it's right. Just virtue of the context, the structure. This is the corporate template, is how we manage messages and people. It's how we package experience. It's all of this stuff that these emergent pastors, I mean, when it was amazing, because Grand Rapids, Michigan has had its own episodes of this. And I'll probably maybe talk about some of that, because of course, a lot of ties between the CRC and Grand Rapids, but Rob Bell goes to Grandville, Michigan, which is a suburb of Grand Rapids. They buy this old defunct Grand Village Mall. And of course, I remember that before because my mother-in-law lived pretty close to there. And so my wife's family's all in that Grandville area. And, you know, so they buy this mall and they refit this mall. And of course, Rob Bell goes there and he's the celebrity pastor. But then he moves on to go to bigger platforms like Oprah's Superstar Sunday. I don't remember what it was really called, but and so then I was over on the website and just kind of clicking through, and now during COVID watching some of the videos, and now they're the Mars Hill Bible Church. And I thought, wow, there's just so many layers, because in Grand Rapids, if you're going to be Fountain Street, which is like the old mainline liberal Baptist church, Northern Baptist church that went totally mainline, that isn't going to sell in Grandville. So you're going to be, it's just fascinating watching all of the layers interact. But of course, zip code matters. And so Seattle is going to play out very differently than suburban Grand Rapids.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, there's two ways of having a really successful company, right? And we'll okay. You could sell a product that's broad, that has broad appeal, and, you know, just, you know, get, just, we're going to scatter our marketing across everyone and we're going to pull from the 80%. That's a viable strategy. Or you can cater your product to the 10 or 20% and get almost all of them, right? Because if I'm catering to 80%, even if I only pick up a fraction, it's still a lot of people. It's a lot of customers. Or I can cater to the 10 or 20%. And that's what Mars Hill did in Seattle, is they catered to the 10 or 20% that were not being served or felt alienated from the local churches. And they built a corporation around it. But that's the only, the corporations, that's the only way we know how to sell things to crowds. Like that's how we do it. And that's what you become if you want to become, if you become a big church. Even if it grows organically, you didn't really plan to have 1,000 people. Once you have 1,000 people, you need to talk to 1,000 people.
Right.
Right. And then you need a way for those people to talk to the people they know. And like it all of a sudden becomes like a whole different problem, because Mark's not going to have coffee with every random person who wants to go and like meet Marcel. But if I was going to move to Sacramento and I was interested in your church, I could email you and be like, hey, I want to grab coffee and get to know you and your church and see if this is a good fit for me or whatever. Mark can't do that. Now Marcel, the institution, is speaking to crowds. And the corporate, that's the only way we know how to do it. That's why corporations do it that way.
Yeah.
And so it's almost inevitable. But the same thing is true for Christianity Today, which is why it seems like a piece of Netflix, you know, production. That's the only way they know how to do it.
Yeah. 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 Oh, there's so much there in terms of, because I've seen churches that have decided. So the church I went to in Grand Rapids, Madison Square, when I went there, I mean, so I was, you know, at Calvin, and Calvin's a pretty white school. And so I didn't grow up with all that whiteness around me. So I went to, you know, went to a church in the hood, but that church was sort of like Northside because it was Dutch CRC, but it was also African-American. And the new thing was that there were some old people from the charismatic movement. So when I started going, there was like 250 people going there, but in Grand Rapids, in that little CRC niche market, you get a certain vibe. And so when I was there, we went from like 250 to 750, you know, three services on a Sunday morning in a place like an old 250 people, and it's exciting and there's buzz and it's popular. And that church decided, well, we don't want to grow big, so we're going to do the multi-campus thing. But there's always the question, are you going to have the big head on the screen?
Right.
Or are you going to say, no, there's a medium-sized church here, there's a medium-sized church there. But then once you commit to that size, all those other metrics that you talked about, having a nursery that can deal with an autistic kid, having you know, a degree of competence and excellence in terms of grief counseling, premarital counseling, right. What does the coffee taste like? How is the music tuned to the people? You know, it's so funny because people will, I'll still get people come and visit Living Stone sometimes who watch the channel. I try to warn them. I said, now buckle up, bucko. Because it isn't me in the little corner of my office here. Right. I don't have enough control to reliably deliver a particular experience that is supposed to induce, you know, all of this stuff that all of this corporatism is really good at.
Yep. No, I mean, Marcel had they had professional therapists and counselors for people that you could go to that was paid for by the church. They had bands. There were like five or six bands that would rotate through the campuses. So you had different live music. It didn't seem like recycled. It seemed like production. The people who handled the video production, the music, the sound, all that kind of stuff. These are people that were professionals. This is what they did for a living. On the side, they made like music videos and things like that. Like this wasn't like random volunteer or anything. It was a production. And I wasn't, even though I came from Summit, which was a large, you know, church, this was a whole nother level. I'd never seen anything like this outside of like a concert, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like in terms of a live experience that they're putting on, it was a professional experience. It was a corporate experience, and they were good at it because you did get those feelings, right? You got the feel, like everything from the songs that they picked out to the way it interacted and went into the sermon and then out of the sermon, back to the sounds, back to like communion and the silence and all that kind of stuff. That was all really well done. I mean, and there's a reason that people go. They get an experience there that I don't think that we should be dismissive of. I think that that's real. Like that matters to people. It resonates with people. And that's one of the things that Jim, my wife's uncle, writes about. Is like it's giving them something that a small church can't give them.
Yep.
For better or for worse. But what you end up doing is you end up forming essentially small little churches within the church. And that's what you saw with the community group and the elders. Like whenever they left, like everyone, the whole group left, and some of them splintered and went to different churches. But a lot of times they just picked a new church and went there together. And just like, we're just all going to go here now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So anything else in this that you wanted to get off your chest?
No, I think that's it. I think I ranted a little bit about both my admiration for and my frustration with the podcast. But yeah, I do think that I think it's worth listening to. I would encourage people to listen to it, but just be thoughtful about what you're hearing and what you're not hearing. Like who is it that they're choosing to bring in to talk about this? And don't just be mindful of that, because I think that it's a shame, because I do want to have I do think we should have a conversation about the hierarchies within a church, about how do we hold people accountable, about how to make sure that what are the warning signs of someone like this being in charge. I think all of this is super helpful. At the same time, we should do it in such a way that it's edifying to the church, so that we can actually improve on those things, as opposed to just now everyone just becoming egalitarian or whatever, in terms of your, that's beside the point. There's a deeper thing that's going on here than just our differences of theology about marriage or whatever. That is a little bit frustrating to me about the podcast, because I don't know that it's asking all those same questions, and I don't know if it's going to be as helpful in that way. I see a lot of armchair trauma experts now talking about things, and I just don't think it's super helpful. This is like you said earlier, this is unhealthy. This was an unhealthy church. Okay, well, what does health look like? How do we know to spot healthy versus unhealthy? A lot of people feel like they're being abused, that are just being disciplined a lot of times. And so how do we have this conversation? And the podcast just doesn't go there in any kind of, in a way that I think, maybe it'll spur a bunch of conversations, but I don't think the podcast itself is helpful in that way. And I worry that it's like a reality TV show almost, where I feel sometimes, I think it's worth listening to. Be thoughtful whenever you listen to it. But sometimes, honestly, I feel like I'm listening to gossip. Sometimes I feel like I'm sitting there, I'm like, is this edifying? Is this for the purposes of improving? Or is this because it's a salacious tale and you'll hear more after the break kind of thing? right. I mean, you get that sense too, right? You're eagerly anticipating the next episode, right? And it's kind of like, I'm on the edge of my seat. I need to hear what's next. And so part of it feels like gossip to me. And I think there's legitimate criticism. I've given some here of Marcel that needs to be had. But sometimes the podcast, I think, veers too much into the salacious gossip realm. I don't know exactly what the point is sometimes that they're trying to make. Or I do. I suspect that the point that they're trying to make is not totally upfront with the listener. So anyway, that's my take on it.
Well, and some of the high production values, let's say, gives itself to that. I mean, one of the things that I've been paying attention to as I listen to the podcast is how often you sort of have this musical background to one of the expert. And it's it's almost like I'm having a conversation with someone, but let me rub your shoulders while I talk to you. And it's like, what are you doing?
are you trying
to give me information, or are you trying to, a spoonful of sugar makes a lot of stuff go down.
Yeah. Well, I there's this, I'll send it to you. Maybe you can link to it, but there's this fake political ad. I think it was put up by Reason Magazine, but it was a fake political ad of our candidate. And then it has in the background a kid running in the meadow and it's light music and everything else. And their candidate, and they have terrorists in the background. And they're not actually saying anything about policy. It's just the framing, the color, the background, all that kind of stuff matters. And that's what I get. That's my, again, the podcast is really good at that. They'll have Mark saying something and it's almost ominous, the way that he was saying it. And then but then their expert will come in and see, I can explain all this by psychologically explaining where he got it from. And, you see the feminist movement in the 1970s and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, it's a little bit subversive for my taste. I'd rather have the cards a little bit more on the table so that we can be more thoughtful. So I think it's worth listening to. Just be thoughtful when you listen to it, I think.
All right. That's a good way to end. Well, thank you, Tripp.
Thanks. Good to see you.
And I'll post this probably tomorrow.
Okay. Sounds good.
Take care.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye.